Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey folks, it's Evan Ratliff, your co-host of the Longform Podcast. We are on hiatus this week, so we're sending you an old episode that we love, which is an interview that I did a little while back with Samin Nosrat. She's the author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. And at this time, not at the time we did the interview, she is now the star of an incredible Netflix program of the same name. So if you hadn't heard of her then, you've probably heard of her now. This was a really fun interview, and we thought you might like to hear it again. So happy holidays, everyone, and we'll see you in the new year. Samin, welcome to the Longform Podcast.
It's a lifelong dream to be here.
You're the first person to ever say that, I have to say. But it's wonderful to have you on. We have a lot of friends in common, and I've met you before, I think, through Pop-Up Magazine when you did that years ago. But the occasion of getting to talk to you and you being in town is that you have this book out, which I am absolutely fascinated with, and I want to talk about in great depth. But first, I want to talk about how you became a chef at all. Okay. Well, we should say, like, this book, which is called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, is a book about cooking that's also sort of a cookbook. I mean, it is a cookbook, but I perceived it kind of differently than a normal cookbook. You can describe it better than me, perhaps.
That's about, I have no really line. I'm like a cooking school in a book, or for a while I was calling it an uncookbook. Oh. Or unrecipes, or I don't know. It's just my philosophy on cooking and teaching you how to cook everything.
Yeah. But a big part of it is the story of how you became a cook, how you became a chef. So let's start there, because you didn't grow up wanting to be a chef, although it sounds like your mother was an incredible cook.
Yeah, my mom is a great cook. And I always say I really have always loved to eat, which I believe is probably the biggest prerequisite to being a good cook. So yeah, I had that part in line. But it was never my goal to be a chef. It didn't even ever occur to me that that could be something I could do. I didn't spend a ton of time in the kitchen as a kid. My brothers and I my family's from Iran, and my mom cooks really beautiful Persian food, which is what we grew up eating every day. And so there's a lot of handwork and just like busy work involved in making Persian food. There's so much vegetable prep and like chopping herbs and picking fava beans, and so we were a lot of times enlisted to help with those things that, like, many hands popping fava beans makes it goes a lot faster. But I did not have ambitions of working in a restaurant. I didn't even think about people who worked in restaurants.
And did you, the way you describe your mother's cooking, I mean, it sounds amazing, but I wondered if the things you're describing, like the snack that you describe that your mom brings when you go to the beach, which sounds extraordinary, is just the Persian cooking equivalent of like my mom making bologna sandwiches?
Yeah.
Or if it's actually your mom took things to a different level than you would find in an ordinary
Persian household.
Persian household.
She is an extraordinary cook, for sure. Like, I've eaten at a lot of other Persian households, and my mom's food is really good. People even who are not related to her would come to our house to eat her food. But I do think there are some Iranian sensibilities in cooking that just sort of line up with where I ended up with this book and sort of my philosophy of what good food is. So our snack that we had, which was lavash bread and feta cheese and cucumbers or sometimes cold grapes at the beach, it was really delicious, but that's a pretty common snack. So mm-hmm.
I should also add that in case my mom is listening, that she was also a really good cook, that a fried bologna sandwich, which we had all the time, is a Southern delicacy.
Sounds really good.
And yeah. It was, I would eat one right now.
Me too.
So you didn't grow up, that you didn't say, all right, now I'm going to go to cooking school, now I'm going to do this. But I love the story of how you first got a job. I mean, first of all, you started at the top in terms of restaurants.
Where, yeah. Kind of, it was very, the whole thing was very serendipitous and very poetic and made for a great introduction to a book. So basically what happened was I moved to Berkeley to go to college. I grew up in San Diego, and so I came to Northern California to go to college, where I knew I wanted to be an English major. I thought I would graduate and be a poet. I wanted to go and get an MFA in poetry. And around the time it started to occur to me that maybe that wasn't going to happen was when I accidentally fell into this restaurant. And the way what happened was, when you come to Berkeley and you go to your freshman orientation, one of the things they inevitably say during that first week is, there's this restaurant in Berkeley, this famous restaurant called Chez Panisse. And to me, having grown up in San Diego, mostly eating home-cooked food, sometimes eating pizza and Chinese food and Mexican food, I had zero concept of what a famous restaurant was. This was 1997. There were not, you know, food blogs. There was no Anthony Bourdain or celebrity chefs on TV.
Right.
There was maybe there was the Food Network. And I remember I did enjoy watching that, but you mm-hmm. know, chef life was not fetishized at that time. So I just didn't understand what a famous restaurant was. Like I just didn't really. So I was like, okay, well, that'll probably never be part of my life. And then the next year I fell in love, and my boyfriend, who was also a student, was from San Francisco. And so a big part of how we spent our time was eating, and he was showing me all the places that he loved to eat at growing up. And his dream had always been to eat at Chez Panisse. So we decided to save our money. I think we saved our money for 7 or 8 months. And it was like, we had this little box and we'd make bets, and whoever lost put the money in the box or the leftover laundry quarters or whatever.
Like that you literally saved change.
Yeah. No, it was literally change. Yeah. I mean, that's all we had. And so we saved that. And I remember the day of our reservation, we went to the bank and we exchanged it for two $100 bills and two $20 bills. And I felt this like overwhelming guilt that we were about to spend $220 on dinner. I mean, it was insane. I was like, you know, how are we going to justify this? And he calmed me down. He's like, we got to go do this. We've been saving for a long time. So we went and had this dinner. And Chez Panisse is divided into two restaurants. There's the sort of less formal cafe upstairs that has an a la carte menu, and the more formal original restaurant downstairs. So we were thinking we would only ever have one shot to go there, so let's go for the restaurant.
Go to the downstairs. Because yeah. That's what I remember from living in the Bay Area. Yeah. It was always like, well, you could get in the upstairs.
Yeah, maybe. But the downstairs. Yeah. I mean, they're both wonderful. So we ended up going downstairs. I was 19 years old. And so we had this amazing dinner, and the food was wonderful. And I do remember what we had that night. But to me, like, what I remember so much more clearly is I had never been to a restaurant where I felt so cared for. It felt like eating in someone's home, where there was always someone tending to you, making sure you had all the bread and butter that you needed, all of the water, your wine was always poured. They were bringing us everything we could have possibly wanted the moment right before we realized we needed it. And it was amazing. And so the dessert was chocolate souffle. And when the server brought it to us, she asked me if I had ever had souffle before or if she could show me how to eat it. And I was like, oh yeah, please show me, like, how does one eat this? And so she's like, oh, you poke a hole in it with your spoon and you pour the sauce in, and that way every bite has some sauce in it. So I did that, and then she said, how is it? And I was like, well, it's really good, but you know what would make it even better is some cold milk. And and she was like, what? And she laughed at me and she was like, you want milk? Which at the time I had no idea of knowing that, like, in fine dining, like, milk is considered for babies. Like, even to have a cappuccino after 10 a.m. is considered, like, you're so uncouth. And so,
but if you were eating, like, some cookies.
Totally.
Like, for a dessert.
And I still think, to me, like, I'm like, oh, warm brownie, cold milk. Like, that's totally good. So she went in, she got the milk. And then she also brought us like two glasses of dessert wine to show us the refined accompaniment. And this was sort of like a generous sort of act. And yeah, it was really sweet. And it just was this magical, inspiring, enchanting experience. And so I wrote a letter to Alice Waters and to the restaurant asking to be a busser.
Which you hand delivered to the restaurant, as I understand it.
Yeah. And I brought it in and they were like, oh, well, you just need to bring that over to the floor manager. So they took me over to the office. And the floor manager was the souffle lady. So she remembered me and I remembered her. And I think, you know, in retrospect now, like all these years of knowing how restaurants work, I think she was really desperate. I think someone had probably just quit because she was like, can you start tomorrow?
And well, it made me wonder. I mean, it's like the power of writing a letter to someone. But also, did you ever ask like Alice Waters or someone there, like, how many letters do they get from people probably in culinary school who are like, I'll do anything. I just want to come work there. I just want to apprentice with you and see. I mean, they must get
dozens a day, like yeah. So many letters like that. And so I think coming in was a big part of it. I think her remembering me and I think the timing. I did literally start the next day. So I really think they were desperate. She was like, you're fine. Yeah. And so I started bussing tables and, you know, like the very first task they had me do, they walk you through the kitchen into the dining room where like I was supposed to vacuum the dining room. And I remember, you know, the kitchen's lined with, the walls are lined with copper. And the cooks are all wearing their like gleaming white coats. And when they smile, it's almost like I really felt like I was in a cartoon or something because they smile and it's like ding, you know, like their teeth are gleaming and they're all just so professional and quiet and masterful. And I had never been in a place that was so efficient and beautiful and enchanting. And so immediately I was in love with this place. It just felt so incredible to be part of something like that. And also, I'm like the child of immigrants. I'm a crazy, insane overworker, overachiever. I always went to public school and was always like in the smart kids classes being like, why isn't everyone else working harder? And Chez Panisse was the first time I felt like I was sort of among people who were all these incredibly overachieving, highly performing people with the highest standards. And it was every day this awakening where, you know, you would meet a cook and they would be making the most beautiful thing. And then later I'd find out that she'd ridden the women's Tour de France the year before, you know, or wow. like there was a bartender there at that time who came and tended bar for fun. And really what his day job was he was a Harvard trained architect with this like incredible architecture firm. There were just these people who all were magnificent, especially for a young person who's just looking for role models and stuff, you know. And Chez Panisse, by that time, I started working on the 28th birthday, I think, of the restaurant. It had been there for 28 years. Mm-hmm. It was running like a machine. Mm-hmm. There was a proper way to tie the trash bag to take it out.
Whoa.
Everything had been thought of, you know? And so to me, it was like I had arrived, you know, like there was a right way to do everything and I wanted to learn it. And so this was that moment when I was realizing like there were still like job fairs on campus. And I remember as an English major, I was like, am I going to have to get a job in advertising? Like I think it was sort of this, the fates aligned. It was a moment where I needed to figure out something to do. And then I had like the most beautiful, enchanting possible thing to do right in front of me. So within 3 or 4 weeks, I started begging them to let me volunteer in the kitchen. And I started coming in like, you know, at 6 a.m. and peeling garlic and straining chicken stock and doing whatever they would let me do. And yeah, I fumbled for a really long time. They gave me a long list of cookbooks to read. I continued bussing too, and they were like, while you're bussing, make sure to watch the cooks as much as you can, watch what they're doing, pay attention. And so I just tried to soak it all in, and then eventually they gave me a job. Well, first they hired me as an intern, which mm-hmm. is an unpaid job, mm-hmm. and I worked unpaid for about a year while I did other jobs after I graduated. And then eventually, finally, I got hired for the lowest job in the kitchen, which was called pasta, lettuce, and garde-manger. And pasta, lettuce is the person who comes in and makes the fresh pasta for the restaurant and then also washes all the greens and washes all the lettuces. And the garde-manger would be translated as like keeper of the food. And really the person inventories what's in all the walk-ins and gives that list to the chef in the morning when he or she arrives so that the chef can write the menu based on what's there and what's coming and make sure that food isn't going bad, accepts deliveries and puts away like 50-pound bags of flour or like carries in whole pigs and whole lambs from the street, but doesn't really ever get to cook. The only cooking that either of those people really ever do is making and rolling out the pasta dough and then also making the staff meal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the like grunt work, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know how much that job makes now, but at the time I made $10 an hour, you know, which thankfully my rent was $330 a month or something.
Those were
you
the
know?
Days.
But
when you talk about how you or you write about how you then, you know, eventually you like became a chef there, and then eventually became chef at your at another restaurant where you're the you know basically in charge. But I'm curious, in that time frame, was there a point at which you said, I can do this? Like, was there something that you made that you were sort of like, oh, I'm a real chef now? Or did it just sort of like accrue over time? I'm interested in this also in context of the book, because a lot of what you talk about is like, anyone can cook. And I'm curious at what point someone crosses over from like, I don't really know what I'm doing, to like, okay, I know what I'm doing.
Wow, that's a good question. I had a journal that I would go and at the end of every workday and write everything that I had done that day. I'd write every new skill that I had learned and who taught it to me.
Oh, wow.
And it was little, like, it actually gives me great joy to open it and read it. And it was things like, today I learned how to fillet a canned anchovy. You know, like the most basic things. Lori taught me how to do it by running it under the water, you know. And so there was a point at which I no longer wrote in that journal. And I think that's probably about the time when I got confident enough. And so, but I guess to come back to the book and like how everything sort of synergized into this philosophy for me is that at Chez Panisse, the menu changes every single day. And even before I was hired, it was insanely overwhelming because I was this like very eager student at school, this trying to always please my, you know, teachers and parents and everything. And I was in this place where I knew nothing. There was nothing I could do right. They would send me to get parsley and I would come back with cilantro because they were like, I couldn't tell them apart, you know. And there were any mistake that could be done, I absolutely committed that mistake. And so we would come in every single day and sit down with the chef, who had by then received the inventory and written the menu for the day based on what we had and like what was in season and what he or she felt like making, basically. And then there would sort of be this dreamy menu meeting where the chef would describe what he or she envisioned for the menu and talk everyone through the basics of making the dish, very vague amounts, and then send everyone off to go make the stuff. And so I just would sit there reeling because half the time I didn't even know what they were talking about. They were saying things like beef daube. I didn't know what that was. Or, you know, like poulet au la Provençal. I was like, what is that? You know, I didn't even know the words to translate what they were talking about, let alone like how they could possibly be made. They never really said, oh, this should be in the oven for 45 minutes at 350 degrees. They never said, you'll need 8 cups of that and 6 cups of that. Nobody ever opened a cookbook. No one ever looked at recipes. Very rarely, for certain things, we looked at recipes. But somehow, every day, people would go make the stuff, whether it was from France or sometimes inspired by India or Italy or Spain or Morocco. And I just didn't understand how these people knew how to make anything and everything without a cookbook, when I was always sent home every day to, like, and my homework was always like, go read that cookbook.
Yeah.
So there didn't seem to be a connection between like what was my education and what was actually happening. And I was reeling for a really long time. I felt like I was treading water for about a year. And then eventually I started to see these patterns. And a lot of what helped actually was I would sometimes help on the pastry side and sometimes on the savory side. And I started to see like what was similar. And so I noticed, for example, on the pastry side, we almost always baked everything around 350 degrees. Whereas on the savory side, we almost always, when we wanted to brown stuff, we'd put it into a much hotter oven, like whether it was 400 or 425 or 500. And even on the savory side, the ovens were so well used that all of the temperatures had worn off the dial. So a lot of times cooks just sort of could tell what temperature it was by putting their arm inside the oven. And so I was like, I don't understand how these people know how to do this stuff, you know? And I noticed after a while that we would always bring things up to a boil on the savory side and then turn it down to a simmer. There were very few cases in which we boiled things the whole way through. Every single day at the end of the day, we would go down to the butcher room, butcher the meat, and always salt it for the next day, no matter what it was. So I was like, okay, we're always salting the meat. You know, we're always using this like vast amount of salt in the water. What is it about salt? Butter was always treated one way on the pastry side and it had to be cold so that your tart dough could turn out flaky. But then on the savory side, whenever we put butter or oil in a pan, the pan had to be hot before we put in the fat. And then, so there were just these sort of patterns. And I was like, okay, I'm just kept noticing these words were just floating around, salt, fat, acid, heat, salt, fat, acid, heat. And I realized that it didn't matter what we were making. And really, sometimes when a cook might have been assigned a dish that he or she had not yet made, it wasn't that he or she couldn't like figure out their way, because they knew the general steps of a braise are mm-hmm. like put the vegetables down, brown the meat, put the liquid in, bring it to a simmer, turn it down to a boil. Today's braise might be French and we'll use butter to brown the meat and we'll put bay leaves and black peppercorn in there. Tomorrow's braise might be Indian and we'll put, you know, cumin and turmeric in there. So it was sometimes this thing where I started to see like, oh, I get it. We're always making braises and just the flavorings are changing, or we're always roasting vegetables and maybe the fat that we're using is changing. And so I just started to sort of put together all the pieces of how people cooked without recipes and like following the seasons. And I remember I did finally have like a brilliant mind moment where it all sort of, or beautiful mind.
Beautiful mind moment.
And it all sort of came together. And I went to one of the chefs, Chris Lee, who ended up becoming my mentor. And I asked him, I was like, I think I figured something out. Like, I've noticed every time at Tasters, you guys are always saying like, this needs salt, or it needs a little bit of lemon, it needs some acid or some cheese. Like, it seems like everything is like about salt, fat, acid, and heat. Like, that's the way. I figured it out. And he's like, yeah, duh. Like, we all know that. He's like, all good cooks know that, Samin. But I was like, it's not in any of the books. It's not in anything that you guys have told me to read for this past year. No one has ever sat me down and said, salt, fat, acid, heat, pay attention to these things and you can navigate your way through this kitchen. Yet when I come to you, you say you all know that.
Right. It was just like intuited yeah. underlying principles.
And even 2 days ago, I got my final copies of the book and I brought a copy up to Chez Panisse to drop it off for the chefs. And the sommelier who's worked there for, you know, I don't know, probably 35 years or something, he came up to me and he's like, you stole my idea. Like, that's my idea for a book.
Oh, really? Yeah, they're probably, a lot of them are kicking themselves. Probably.
It's really funny. I was like, yeah, I'd never said it was original, you know, since day one. Like, you guys told me this is the thing, but no one ever like quantified it. No one ever sat down and articulated this. And when I did bring it to the chefs at Chez Panisse the next day, the chef sent me a thank you card. And I was like, why'd you send me a thank you card? And she's like, nobody has ever put our way of cooking down in a, this is a cooking school in this book. This explains, I'm going to make all of my cooks read this from now on. So,
oh, well, that's like, high
okay,
praise
cool,
right
I got
there.
It. Yeah.
Well, that, I mean, that was part of what was so intriguing to me reading it. I mean, first of all, it says at the beginning, I recommend reading this book from start to finish, which is a bold thing. That's not really how people, I think, experience cookbooks generally. You're saying, read this first and understand. But it did make me feel like I like to cook and I like to use recipes, but that I never understand why they're telling me to do anything, like put some vinegar in this or do this. You just do it and you're sort of operating from this place of
trust.
Trust and ignorance.
Yeah.
But you had the idea to write the book at what point?
Actually, right then I had the idea.
When you put those
when I was
together.
Probably 20 years old. Yeah, I was like, I'm going to write this book. It's going to be 12 pages long. Like, these things are not that complicated. It'll be just like 3 pages for each thing, done. And I'm going to change the world. And I even like got out a pad. I still have the journal, you know, and I started writing the ideas. And I realized I didn't know enough about cooking or about writing. And so it became the system into which I filed everything that I was learning. And it just, yeah, it's sort of, I don't know that I continued with my dream of writing the book all throughout cooking, but it certainly became the way that I started teaching other cooks how to cook. And it was a really easy lingo. And still now, like, there are cooks who have worked for me at different points who've gone on to become chefs and like win awards and stuff. And I always like email them and congratulate them. And one of them recently wrote me back. He's like, you taught me how to make salad. Like, it's salt, fat, acid. That's how I teach all of my cooks now. It's just about getting that balance. It's such an easy way to describe this. And I was like, yes.
So at what point did you come back to actually writing the book after you set it aside? Because I know you worked with Michael Pollan on mm-hmm. the book that you were his teacher. Actually, I wanted to ask you, like,
how did that happen?
Well, how did it happen? And then, I'll get to the other question.
So
about it.
I will say, just like that letter at Chez Panisse, like, there have been a series of letters that I've written in my life that have sort of helped me get things. I've asked for things. And so the second letter after the Chez Panisse letter was, when I was working at a restaurant called Ecolo in Berkeley, which is no longer there, I noticed one day.
I ate there.
Oh, you
once,
did?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
For a friend's birthday.
I hope you liked it.
I did like it.
Okay, good. But I saw Michael was coming in the next day, and I was a huge fan of his. He was writing about issues that I cared about. He was writing about food in a way that I didn't feel like other people were writing about, especially in that moment in the early 2000s where he, as sort of an outsider in the food world, as a journalist, was bringing a much broader attention to the issues that we were paying attention to in our restaurants, that I was spending a lot of time researching and learning about. And so I very much admired him, and I noticed he was coming in, so I wrote him a letter, and I said, oh, I'm such a big fan of yours. I would love to come take one of your classes at Cal. I would love to audit your class. Please let me do that. And he wrote me back. I mean, much to his credit, this very busy man wrote me back 3 weeks later.
He must write really good letters.
I don't know. This one wasn't that good.
Did you write letters that people didn't respond to, and where you're like, can you help me?
And they didn't. I mean, there must have been... I don't know. There must have been, right? I don't know. But that one, I don't know. I think that one was really just a jotted down card. Michael's just really good that way. But he wrote me back and he was like, come see me. So I came back and I asked him if I could audit his class. And at first he said no, and I persisted and he let me take it. So that was a really incredible thing for me. That was 2006. I went and took this class at the journalism school at Cal. And, you know, I had spent 8 years by that point developing this incredible food community. And now I stepped into this incredible ready-made journalistic and writing community. So not only did I get to meet Michael and get to know him and work with him, but I also was in this class with these incredible writers who have all gone on to go do amazing work. Like, many of them have been on long form podcasts. And so it was really important in retrospect. It was just an incredible thing for me to find my way into a writing community. And Michael really encouraged me to just keep writing. And he was like, just start, just write for the Edible San Francisco. It doesn't have to be a fancy thing. Like, you just write by writing. So just start writing and keep going. And also, he was about to start work on a book about cooking and human nature. And having been a long-term stalker of Michael Pollan's, I knew that sort of he followed the academic model in his work, and that he would sort of give a talk, maybe turn it into a long-form piece for the Times Magazine or the New York Times, and then that would become sort of the founding chapter of a book. Mm-hmm. So I sort of knew that he was going to write about cooking, because in 2009, this big piece that he wrote, it was called Out of the Kitchen and Onto the Couch.
Yeah.
And I could tell. I knew he was going in that direction. And so I wrote him this letter. I was like, I can tell that you're going to write a book about cooking, and the way that you work is like, you go down, you know, to the ground floor, and you're going to need a cooking teacher. I want to be your cooking teacher. And he wrote me back. He's like, I'm on vacation, Samin. But, you know, a couple months later, he wrote me back. He's like, I had a brilliant idea. I'm going to need a cooking teacher, and I think it should be you. I was like, okay, good idea. So he hired me to teach him how to cook. And so I would go over to their house on Sunday and cook with him and his wife and his son. And it very quickly became this very, like, joyous thing. And also very quickly, because he's super smart and really good at sort of noticing systems and organizing systems and stuff. So very quickly, he picked up on my obsession with these four elements. Mm-hmm. And he would interview me periodically so he could have quotes from me. So one day we were sitting down. He's like, what's the deal? Like, you're so obsessed with sulfa, acid, and heat. And I was like, yeah, that's my system. That's how I teach people how to cook. And I've always thought I would write a book about it. And he was like, there's your book. Because every week at this point, I would come in with like a really harebrained scheme for a book. And like, well, what about a memoir about teaching this gutter punk how to cook? And he would, every week, he'd be like, no, that's horrible. Those ideas are bad. You have to do this one. This one's a good idea. And I said, no, I don't think I can do that. It just seems too hard. It's like that book, it won't have beautiful food photos. I was like, I really want a beautiful book. And he said, listen to me. You live in an insane alternate reality where everybody who you know who's writing books, because I know a lot of chefs mostly, yeah, and him, those people are already celebrities with a profile. And so they're selling their books based on celebrity. But that's not what publishers want. Publishers want a book that's built on a unique and strong idea. And that's what this is. He said, I've never seen this anywhere else. No one's ever written about this.
And he's read probably
every
food book under the sun.
Every freaking food book ever. Yeah. He's like, no one has talked about this. This is your book. Go figure out how to do it. He said, go turn your thing into a curriculum, teach it, and then you'll figure out how to turn that curriculum into a book. So I did exactly what he told me to do, and it worked. Yeah.
Wow, because my question was going to be so much the opposite of that, which was when you were teaching him to cook and he was clearly writing a book about it, were you afraid that Michael Pollan was going to write the book based on your philosophy and take your book? That's what I was.
Oh, really?
I was
That's so
you.
Funny.
Yeah.
I had No, that was not. Also, our minds are so different. You know, it's very funny. We are so different. I'm like motivated in all things by my gut and my heart. And Michael is so analytical and thoughtful and organized. So they're just, I'd never thought in any million years that there would ever be any way that we would be telling the same story. Plus, the other thing that was very funny when he was like, you have to write this book, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. I was like, no, the only reason you want me to do that is because it's divided in four and all your books are divided in four. Like, but I don't think, yeah, that was, there was just never any problem. And you know, today actually, Wendy McNaughton and I,
who illustrated this book and has also been on this podcast.
Yeah, she's quite wonderful. We were talking a little bit about Michael this morning and just appreciating what how much he's done for me and for this book. And I said something like, you know, as much as Michael supported me in making this book and really pushed for me to make it and has seen it at many different points, I really don't think until the moment we gave him the book with the illustrations did he understand how I was trying to undo what a cookbook was and how I was trying to use ideas and illustrations and stories to convey concepts in a new way. And there's also like a lot of hubris involved in ever saying that to somebody. So I could never go to his house and be like, oh no, I'm going to reinvent cookbooks.
Although you're in the Bay Area, so you could have said like, I'm going to disrupt the cookbook industry.
And maybe I'll say that.
Actually, someone probably had given you like a lot of an investment for that.
That's true.
You should use that.
I will. Thank
disrupting
you.
Disrupting the
cookbook. Okay, you get
10%. Okay. But you had, I mean, you obviously had a structure from that, like you had these four things, but that's only a little bit of the way there. And I'm curious, when you sat down to actually write it, had you already been sort of like teaching this to other people in a way that you could then distill it into what's here? Or did you start with a blank page and say, okay, what story do I start with? How do I develop this?
It's been a long road. So as I taught the classes, I developed a curriculum and I had handouts. I had like 20 page handouts for each class. And as I would teach, I also realized that words sometimes weren't enough. So sometimes I would draw very crude illustrations to illustrate certain concepts for my classes. And that was where I started to realize like, oh, maybe illustration is the way to go here. But there were so many things I wanted to accomplish. And then there were also a pile of things I had to accomplish that I didn't want to accomplish, chiefly writing recipes. To me, in some ways, it felt very disingenuous to write an entire book teaching you how to cook without recipes and then following that with another book's worth of recipes. Mm-hmm. But the like realities of the cookbook writing world are that I don't know who you have to be to write a food book without recipes. Like, they just won't publish a book without recipes. So I pretty much had to do that. I also learned over the course of teaching the classes, you know, sometimes I would spend 40 hours with my students over the course of the four classes. And the whole time I'm like, let's taste our way there, guys. Like, just use salt, fat, acid, heat to guide you. You don't need to like refer to recipes. And we'd stand there and make the Caesar salad dressing together and taste it. And does it need more anchovy and Parmesan? And we'd get there and I was so proud of them. And then literally at the like last dinner, they'd be like, okay, so where's the recipe packet? So
they wanted to come out of the class with like a guide that they could go
back
to.
And I realized, I was like, okay, I get it. Like, I can't just like throw the people to the wolves. Like, they need something. So I came to terms with the fact that like, as much as I would like you to not use recipes, I can't expect you to sort of read 200 pages and all of a sudden know how to cook, right? You got to practice your way there. So I also felt like I had to find a way to write recipes that I felt comfortable with. So I knew I had to do recipes. I knew I had to teach you these four elements. I knew there would be some science in there to explain the concepts. I knew that I would use a lot of storytelling and especially stories of my own sort of aha moments and a lot of mistakes, which I have made so many of them, because I kept trying to remember what it felt like to be the person who didn't know, because that's who I was talking to. And so I kept trying to put myself in that position. And, you know, I probably rewrote, it took me, I think, four times of writing the book to get the structure right. The first time I was like, I'm just going to pretend I'm Michael Pollan and write it. That one didn't work. Then I pretended I was my friend Tamar Adler, who wrote this beautiful book called An Everlasting Meal. Who, there's a lot of narrative in there. That didn't work. And then finally, by then, I was at a writing residency in New Hampshire, and I was like, maybe 12 essays will do it, each three essays for each one. That didn't work. So I just had to keep doing it over and over again. There was a lot of heartache. It took me 3.5 years to write the first half of the book, the education part. And it took me 7 months to do the recipes. So recipes are easy. Yeah. Even like testing them multiple times and like all this stuff. But figuring out how to redo something that's been done the same way for hundreds of years is hard.
And then were you under pressure from your publisher to get them what they wanted?
I think the time pressure came from myself for sure. And it was probably in some ways financial, and also because I'm insane and I just wanted to put out something really, really good. And there was a lot. It was really hard and really challenging.
How did you get out?
I had to break it down into pieces. I had to get one section right. For me, the fat section was really hard. So ultimately, I love tidiness in writing a lot. I love systems. I love finding patterns in things. And I kept trying to use patterns and systems that already existed that I had seen in other books. Someone told me to read The Levels of the Game by John McPhee. Mm-hmm. And I read that and I was like, maybe I can use this as a, you know, like I was just reading anything I could get my hands on to try and figure out how to tell this story of going back and forth and like micro macro, all this kind of stuff. And finally, my editor, when I turned in the first version, which was 12 really messy essays that didn't align and there wasn't consistency among the four chapters. There wasn't a way that I felt like I was guiding the reader to somewhere where he or she could know where to expect to go next, you know? And my editor was like, you can't do this. Like, you have to find a way to make these four things the same. And I understood that as a writer, but then as a cook and a person who understood these four elements, I really had a hard time figuring out how to do that because salt, fat, and acid are tangible things and heat is not. There isn't a way where they're equal, you know? And salt comes in one form. It's a mineral. Fat comes in a million different forms and mm-hmm. It plays a million different roles. There were so many ways where I had all the different things that I had ever heard of a writer having, all the post-it note walls, the pieces of paper, you know, like the thing, just like I was trying so hard to figure out an organization. And finally, really what happened was I printed everything out and I cut everything up into pieces of like what it was that I was teaching and what's the story that I was telling. And I just started repasting stuff. And I started to see I could break it down into science and flavor, that those were sort of the two things I was trying to tell about each element, and that I could walk you through them. And the most complicated science had to do with fat.
Uh-huh.
And there were a lot of moments I got to have aha moments as a writer that felt so good. Like, and just as a thinker, where I had never even as a cook sat down to think about fat and what it does for our cooking. And it was really easy for me to think about what salt does for our cooking. Mm-hmm. Salt makes food taste good. When you put salt on meat in advance, it helps it have a more tender and moist texture when it's cooked. And that's about it. Like, there are other things, but that's pretty much it. Whereas fat does a million different things. So I had to be like, what is fat doing? And I just started making lists of what does fat do and how and when and all this kind of stuff. And I started to see patterns that really fat's about texture. And then I was like, okay, how many textures can I get from fat? And so I made these crazy lists. I read as many books as I called all the cooks I knew. And the five textures that I could figure out that fat yielded were crispy, flaky, tender, light, and creamy. And so then I was like, okay, if I can break this down, then the science part can be these five textures and the flavor part can be about flavor. And I got one. So once I got fat done, then I knew I could do the other ones. And it all fell into place a lot more quickly. But I also had not been trained really ever as a journalist or a science writer. Mm-hmm. And like, that was really tricky. Like, there's a lot of chemistry and I'm not a chemist. I have no idea how to do any of this stuff. And so, yeah, there were a lot of pitfalls.
You come out of a Berkeley, Oakland, Bay Area food scene, which is there's just a lot going on there. And it's like a real hotbed for great food of all different varieties and different styles of cooking and everything else. But there's also like, it feels like there's a line between like ingredients and sourcing the ingredients and like something that's very either precious or pretentious or is way along that line of sort of like artisanal mayonnaise that feels like it's tipped over into something else. And if I felt like that was also something that to me you had to navigate, was like, this book can't feel like it's on that side of it because then it's easily dismissible.
It's limiting. Yeah. Absolutely. To me, I wanted maybe the tidiest way to like illustrate this is the book is being made into a show.
Mm-hmm.
And
a television show.
And I had to go audition for the like network executives. And when I was doing that, you know, I did the whole Samin experience and I like, cooked for them and I was my silliest self and telling them these stories and sort of explaining these four elements. And I that morning I had gone to the farmer's market in LA and bought like the most beautiful lettuces and the most beautiful loaf of bread I could find. I did the full chez Panisse. I did the full thing that I have been trained to do. And I set up the scene and made the food so beautiful and perfect. And then they came to this thing and they were totally enjoying it. And they were supposed to stay an hour and they stayed 2 hours and they're having this great time. And then at the end, one of the guys, you know, they're asking me all these questions and he was like, okay, so I get it. So this whole thing, it's about the artisans for you. Like it's about the purveyors. And I just said, no. I said, you know, to me, I have been trained in a kind of cooking. I will never not cook that way. I will never not care about that stuff. But that's not my message. My message is that I really think that anybody can cook. I think that anybody who wants to can learn. And I think that it will make your life better and fill your life with joy. And that's what I would like to do. And I don't think it's that hard. And I think if you learn these four things, you can do it. And it took me a lot of months of really sitting with myself and thinking about all of the chez Panisse cooks who've become authors who've come before me and other authors not from chez Panisse who've come before me and thinking about how they've approached this and maybe succeeded or not succeeded in the preciousness or not preciousness,
mm-hmm.
and to figure out what my line was and would be. And really, to me, I realized it had to be about good cooking and it couldn't be about organic food. I never want to shame someone into feeling like their ingredients aren't good enough or that their sensibilities aren't good enough. I want to encourage you and make you feel really good about what you're cooking, no matter where your ingredients come from. And I think ultimately, if you love cooking and you get better at it, that you will want to buy fresher and better ingredients. You will develop a curiosity that takes you to the Indian grocery store or to the farmer's market. So I don't need to tell you that that's how you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, yeah, I absolutely felt like I had to navigate that because those values are deeply important to me, but that's not my message. Other people have already given that message out to the world.
So. Yeah. And on the other side of that, while we're on the topic, I was just genuinely curious, like when you were cooking at places like Chez Panisse and Ecolo?
Ecolo, yeah.
Those are high-end places, but presumably like a lot of people that pay that kind of money to go like also really appreciate food. But I'm just curious, like what was your experience relative to how many people were kind of people who had money who didn't really appreciate the food versus like people like when you saved up with your boyfriend at the time and came and like how many assholes do you have to cook for at a place like that?
So many. I mean, the thing about it, especially now, is food has become like a cultural marker, right?
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of people who hire good cooks, you know, to come in their homes and cook stuff or be private chefs or come into fancy restaurants for whom it's just like a notch on the belt, right? And they don't care about the food and they don't care about the, like, the provenance of this egg, you know, which I deeply care about. But
or they care about it to the extent that they want to tell 10 other exactly. people, like, I ate the egg that was the rarest egg that was gathered in Antarctica. Or
there's a lot of that. And to me, that's, you know, it's funny because I've ended up, I don't love eating in restaurants anymore. I'm kind of over it. There was a period in which I was like, needed to know all the restaurant gossip, eat in all the restaurants. And to me now, I've really distilled what I care about around food and it's sitting around with the people I love. And every time I come to New York, people are like, where are you eating? And I'm like, at my friend's house, you know?
Yeah. So you're not sort of like hitting all the top restaurants and seeing what they're doing. And
no, I mean, I'll go if someone wants to go with me, but it's not how I want to spend my money or my time. I have three places that I go to in New York, like every single time. And they're really fun and they just taste really good. And I feel really good after I eat there. And that's what I want. So,
yeah. Well, I'm interested in this analogy that you use a lot in the book, or it comes up at different parts of the book about cooking being like jazz. Because I at one point wanted to be a jazz piano player when I was younger. And one thing I discovered is that it's sort of generally true in the same vein that like if you learn the scales and you learn the chords, you can then improvise on top of the chords, which is sort of what you're saying about cooking. You learn the principles and then you can improvise. But it's also true that like I very quickly ran into the fact that there were some people who were way more talented than me who could like really digest those concepts and like they had genuine musical talent in a way that I did not. And I assume that like cooking has a spectrum along that you feel like you could pick up those concepts quickly because you have a mind for cooking? Or do you think that's absolutely not true, that anyone could just learn these things and then practice and then be able to make great stuff?
Man, I really think cooking is about practice. Hmm. And is there one of those sayings that's like, talent is practice plus, I don't know.
I'm sure there's like one of those inspirational posters.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I do believe in talent. I don't think I'm the most talented cook in the world. I think I'm really determined and I work really hard. And I think I have like a crazy amount of professional resilience that just allows me to fail. And I think there's a lot of failing involved in cooking that you have to be okay with. And one of the beautiful things for me is like, cooking and writing, I kind of couldn't exist as a cook or a writer. I kind of need to be both because they fulfill these two totally different parts of myself and my brain. And cooking is really social. It's very physical. And also, you don't have any time to become attached to your product, right? Like you literally, it's gone. You hand it off and someone eats it. And literally tomorrow, it's shit, right? Like, like I can't sit around and be like, on April 22nd, you know, 1999, I cooked the best. I don't remember, you know? Whereas with writing, it's the exact opposite. It's super solitary. It's super cerebral. And you have all the time in the world to get attached to your thing and like freak out about it. And I have so much, like, I need probably up my anti-anxiety medication or something. But like, you know, and so I think if I were one or the other, I would probably drive myself crazy. Like I wouldn't be satisfied intellectually if I were only a cook, but I definitely would probably like take myself to the brink of insanity if I were only a writer. I need some sort of a physical outlet. And they're very complementary and it's really nice to have two things to do. But I don't think I have anything other than resilience. And it's been really nice to sort of try and apply that resilience to the writing, which like I was forced to do, right? I had to throw it away and start over.
And now you're maybe entering like a third dimension of this, which I don't want to say celebrity exactly, but you got a TV show that's network TV show that is in process now and the book's coming out. So I'm kind of catching you at this moment of like things are building and I'm interested in how that feels right now.
It's a weird moment, dude. It's a really weird moment. I mean, it's very weird. I have had these two careers for so long where I cooked for $10, $12, $14, $15, $18 an hour for a lot of years while I was watching all of my friends like become fabulous lawyers and consultants and make all this money and stuff. And they would come eat the restaurants and they were like so impressed. And I was like, yeah, but I'm the one who's like on my knees at the end of the night, you know, cleaning the walk-in floor and like throwing away rotten chicken stock. Like you get to go home to the fabulous life and I can't even afford to eat in this restaurant where I work.
That's a wild
idea. Yeah. and same thing with writing. Like I've had my head down for a long, long time writing this stuff. And I mean, taking 4 years to write any book and definitely taking 4 years to write a cookbook, it's kind of unheard of. Like people crank them out in a year or 2 years. I have one friend who wrote two books in the time it took me to write one. It's just, I've had my head down for a long time. So it's very surreal to be in this moment where not only is the book about to come out tomorrow, but like, it's going to be a show and it's overwhelming. It's exciting. I go to a therapy a lot. I talked about like, I spend a lot of time in therapy. A lot of time. and trying to figure out what it is that I want and how do I make time to do the things I care about and how do I take care of myself. What's been interesting is I have always been a student and like a deep believer in practice. You know, when I first started cooking, like all the chefs at Chez Panisse, they would just say to me almost every day, they're like, oh yeah, you won't know anything till you've been cooking for 10 years. And this was before Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours thing. But then that came out and I was like, oh, 10,000 hours is 10 years, you know? And there is a way where after 10 years, it just becomes part of your body, you know, and your body knows how to do it. And my senses are attuned. I can hear a piece of chicken burning from two rooms away, right? There are ways where I just know it. I just know it in my bones. And that was really drilled into me as a cook. And so in a way, I had been writing for newspapers and magazines and stuff before I sold the book, but it felt wrong in some ways to get this huge book deal and have this huge expectation. I had that thought a lot. I was like, how am I supposed to deliver the masterful thing the first time? am I not supposed to have like a million chances to make mistakes first, like I have with cooking? So that was something I had to really work through. And it's interesting too, I haven't done a ton of the filming yet, but just we've done a lot of practice work, and I've learned a lot. There's so much to know, and like there's angles and ways you're supposed to stand and talk to the camera or don't talk to the camera. And just ways to be. And I, as you may have noticed in our time here, am very verbose. And so they, you know, you're supposed to speak in compact sound bites and like all of these things that I'm learning. And
they got to do those teasers for the episode. They got to have those.
And so it's this interesting thing where like the stakes keep getting higher every time I'm doing any of these things. And yet I'm still an amateur at every time I'm doing a new thing. I haven't mastered the thing. I don't know what I'm doing. So part of it is maybe trying to figure out if I can like adjust my philosophy. And I do still believe in practice. And a lot of people are like, you know, if you watch season 5 of, I don't know, Oprah versus season 1 of Oprah, like, of course she gets better with time, you know? And so I'm like, okay, yeah, I guess there's a, clearly they see something in me. There's a way where we can make something together and it will just have to get better over time. And I have to be okay with putting out something less than my best or imperfect. And
you don't get 10 years of television.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, until I got 10 years of practice. I was telling my agent yesterday, I was like, oh yeah, when we like work out this deal with the network, make sure you tell them the Samin way is like we sell the thing and then I like agonize over it for 4 to 6 years and then I'll deliver a really good thing. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll just build that into the contract. Yeah. Well, the last thing I want to ask you about is Golden Boy Pizza.
Oh my God. Do you love it? Oh, do you love it?
Is it still there?
It's still there. It's still, what's your favorite New
York? I was so struck by that. Well, the funny thing is that I was diagnosed with celiac disease in over 10 years ago now. But prior to that, Golden Boy Pizza in North Beach in San Francisco was like where I wanted to end up at the end of any given night. Absolutely had to end up at Golden Boy. This particular friend of mine who lived in North Beach, we would always go there. And then I saw it mentioned in your book. It, more than just being nostalgic, it actually felt to me like just a reference to like this kind of cooking and trying to cook well and this type of food and Chez Panisse and all this, it can be very intimidating. And it can seem like you're not a person who would ever eat a Golden Boy Pizza.
Oh my God. I love, like, to me, it's so funny. Right now, I'm doing a thing for New York Magazine where I have to catalog everything I'm eating for a week. And I'm always like, are they really going to want to know about like the PBJs and the like, and there's a place every time I come to New York, I stay with some friends in Brooklyn Heights and there's a place like, it's called Table 87 on Atlantic. It's like
coal-fired pizza.
Yeah. I love that place. And you go and you get the chili. I just am on a hunt for deliciousness. It doesn't have to be fancy deliciousness, you know, like I'm not a snob. And that's the thing is most of the people who work at Chez Panisse are not snobs either. In fact, Alice will probably kill me for saying this. Maybe she doesn't even know, but, one of my favorite things, which is just this phenomenon that happens every time, is like there's one or two times a year Chez Panisse throws this like wonderful, amazing staff party on the like main farm where almost all of our food is produced. And usually the chefs will cook or they'll hire a former person who cooks just like the most beautiful, you know, like spit roasted lamb or whatever. Like there'll be huge paellas in an 8-foot pan and just this like gorgeous thing. It's like it's dream wedding, basically, worth of food. And it's just this magical thing. And they get buses for us to take us up there so no one has to drive and you can drink. And every year on the way back, like you've spent this whole day eating this magical stuff on the most organic farm in the world. And you come back and everyone's like, let's go to In-N-Out. Like, like there's just a way where like you all, I don't know, we all want deliciousness. And the honestly, all of those foods that are quote unquote like trashy or whatever, not fancy enough. The thing about it is like they're using salt, fat, acid, and heat to make their food taste good too. Like it's just, there was that book that came out a few years ago, Salt, Sugar, Fat. And that was right when I was selling my book that was on the bestseller list. Mm. And everyone was like, shouldn't you be worried? Like this book's about like how the, you know, food industry, big food has used these ingredients to trick us. And like these are bad. These things are bad. And I was like, well, A, like my sugar is not one of my things. And B, yeah, like the idea behind what they're doing and what I'm telling you to think about is the same, which is humans are wired to like salt and to like fat and stuff. And I'm just telling you how to use it better to make your own food taste good. Those guys are like using it to develop stuff to trick you into buying more Doritos or whatever. Right. But like, but it doesn't mean, you know, like, and now you can understand why Doritos are good and maybe eat less Doritos, but just eat some. I still eat Doritos. I mean, I deeply love them. But good cooking, it doesn't have to be fancy. Like, I think anyone can do it.
Well, Samin, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
That's it for the podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Samin once again for coming in back then. Thanks for listening in 2018. We had a great year. We really enjoyed it. We hope that you did too. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. I'm Evan Ratliff. Thanks to Janelle Pfeiffer, our editor, and Tyler McCloskey, our intern, and our sponsors for the year, Pit Writers and MailChimp. We thank them both, and we will be back with a new episode next week in 2019.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Teen Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Teen Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.